Welcome to Trading for Keeps. This is Brian.
And this is Michael. Today, we've got a special guest, Kenneth you know what, Kenny, I didn't get your last name. Polcari. Is that
there
it?
There you go. All right, that works.
Kenny Polcari. Kenny Polcari is a former member of the New York Stock Exchange, worked on the floor for decades. Currently a, managing
partner
of Case Capital Advisors.
Correct.
Also a contributor for CNBC, amongst other news organizations. So, Kenny, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we're really excited to get to know you a little bit. You know, it's so interesting, the market right now, how many people are, you know, overnight millionaires and everything. You don't always meet a lot of people that have been around and also worked on the New York Stock Exchange floor. So if you could give us an introduction to yourself, what was your first interaction with the market? How did you get started?
Well, I was 19. It was 1980. I was a freshman in college, and I'm a kid from Boston. I was going to school in D.C. because I thought I wanted to be a lawyer and a politician and president of the United States. And thank God that didn't happen. But while I was there that freshman year, I had this opportunity to intern on the floor of the exchange. And I thought to myself, what the heck did I want to? Why would a 19-year-old kid want to move to New York City in the summertime? When I could, you know, go back to Boston and spend my summer on Cape Cod, which is what I had every intention of doing, to be a lifeguard on the beach, which at 19 sounds pretty good to me. And so I didn't know what the New York Stock Exchange was. I didn't have a clue of what they did there. I wasn't really sure I wanted to do it. But then, you know, I thought about it. I had a couple of conversations and I decided, you know, okay, let me try this, because what's the worst that's going to happen? I'm going to go there. I'm going to like it or I'm going to hate it. If I like it, it could change the course of my life. If I hate it. So you put it on your resume, you check it up for experience and you move on. And so I moved to New York City in the summer of 1980. I lived right downtown in the financial district, which today is a very vibrant residential community. But in 1980, it was not that at all. The rents were cheap because it was the financial district, right? So there were just banks and brokers. By 5:30, the place was cleared out. There was nobody down there. It was a ghost town. So I got an apartment. The rents were cheap. It was literally four blocks from the exchange.
A cheap hotel in Lower Manhattan.
A cheap apartment in Lower Manhattan, right?
I love that.
So my first day on the floor, I have to tell you something. If you've never been on the floor, you won't even experience this, because the floor is not even like this anymore because of the technology. But in 1980, when I went there, there were 5,500 type A personalities running around. And type A personalities, of which I'm a type A, type A's, you know how they are, right? They're energized and they're screaming and yelling and they're running around and they got all this energy and they interact with each other and they create this really dynamic atmosphere. And I stepped on the floor of the exchange on that first, it was like around May 15th of that year, and completely in awe once I stepped on the floor of what it was, but more in awe of what was going on there, because I saw all this energy, all this excitement. I heard screaming and yelling and people running around. Now, I didn't understand a thing because, you know, they spoke very much in a language that you didn't understand. You didn't understand until you learned it, right? It was like if somebody picked you up and dropped you in the middle of China, until you learn how to speak their language, you don't understand a thing that they're saying. And so it was the same way on the floor of the exchange, but there was this energy about the place. It was absolutely amazing. And I spent that first summer just being a gopher, right? Go for this, go for that, write reports, go get coffee, go get lunch, because that's what you did. At 19, you didn't know anything, so you couldn't really do anything other than read, ask questions, which is what you were expected to do, and learn and learn the language and understand. And so I was there for about 3 or 4 weeks. And all of a sudden, it just bit me in the backside and wouldn't let me go. It was the most amazing place in the world. And I thought to myself, oh my God, I can't even believe I'm here. I'm doing this. I love it. The idea of being a lawyer or a politician went right out the window. And I made the decision at that moment that I was going to transfer, leave DC, and go back to Boston, go to business school in Boston, and then moved to New York when I graduated. And I had the opportunity to continue to intern there in the summer of 81, the summer of 82. And then I went back because I graduated Boston University in May of 1983, But I think what's really significant about this conversation is what you have to remember, and you guys won't remember it, and I don't know if your listeners will remember it, but in 1982, we had just come out of the Jimmy Carter presidential years. We had just come out of the Iranian hostage crisis. We had just come out of the oil embargo and the oil crisis. The economy was a disaster. Ronald Reagan had just become president. They were working on this massive tax policy, the Reagan tax reform package. Interest rates were 20%. Unemployment was running at 13%. And inflation was running at 10%. Compare that to today, that interest rates are zero. There is no inflation and unemployment is 6.8%, right? And before the crisis, right? And before the, the COVID crisis, unemployment was actually 3.5%, right?
Yep.
And so what people need to understand then in 1982, economically, the country was in a really, really bad place. And if you were anybody who had any money at all, here are your choices. You could take your money and you could go to your broker and you could buy General Electric and Johnson & Johnson and IBM, which are all fine American companies, but they are full of risk, right? Because you buy a stock, there's no guarantee the stock's going to go up. There's no guarantee they're going to pay their dividend. There's no guarantee it's not going to go down. Or you could take your money, no matter what it was, and you could walk across the street and go to the bank and hand your money to the banker who's going to put it in a CD. And you're going to earn 21% on your money, guaranteed riskless sleep at night. Never a question. There was zero risk, zero. And so when you think about what people were doing in 19, anyone who had money in 1981, 82, all the money was in the banks. And so the Dow was trading at 792. Tonight it closed at 30,192. In the summer of 1980, and specifically in August 17th of 1982, the Dow was trading at 792. We'd trade 30 million shares a day. Today, we traded 9 billion shares and we traded 30 million in probably a minute and a half. But then we did it. It took 6.5 hours to do it because it was all pen to paper, face-to-face negotiation, eighths of a dollar. There were only 7 price points to trade, an eighth, a quarter, 3 eighths, half, 5 quarters, 7 eighths. That was it. Today, there's pennies and sub-pennies. Which is a whole nother conversation. And so I was there back in it was the summer of 82, and I was working for this broker, and it was on a Monday. Monday, I believe the date was August 16th. And remember, there was no internet. There's no television. There was no radio. The only way, if you were on the floor, the only way you got information about what was happening in the world was when somebody picked up the phone from the outside and called you to tell you what was happening. So if you were the trader at First Boston, or Brian, you were the trader at Goldman Sachs and you were customers of mine, you guys were sitting up in a big office place and you had access to television and Bloomberg's and information, radio and all that stuff. I didn't. And so you would call me up and you'd say, this just happened or that just happened, right? Which was by design, because when you were on the floor of the exchange representing an institution, if I walked into the crowd with 300,000 IBM to buy, the thought was my job was to react at that moment in time to the market. Who was in the market? Where were the buyers? Where were the sellers? What was supply? What was demand? How am I going to represent that order? I wasn't supposed to be poisoned with some rumor or some event that was happening in the world that might make me react differently in the crowd. Do you understand? And so on this Monday, the rumor started late in the afternoon, 2:30, like that, that there was going to be the surprise announcement by the Fed on Tuesday morning. Now, it was 1982. Paul Volcker was the Fed chair. There was no such thing as a surprise announcement. The Fed came out on Thursday mornings at 8:30. They opened the door. They stepped out to the podium. They said, here's what rates are doing. He closed up his little notebook. He turned around. He shut the door. He didn't sit there and take your temperature and ask you if you were okay. And you want a Xanax. And let's talk about this and make sure that you're okay. None of that bullshit. They came out, they made the announcement, they turned around and they left, and it was up to the market to figure out what was going on. And that was the most spectacular part about the market at that moment, because the market would react. And it was exciting, it was energized, it was the most incredible place. And so nobody really believed that this was going to happen on Tuesday morning because The Fed never made those surprise announcements. So on Tuesday morning, the floor starts to fill up 7:30, quarter of 8 o'clock. People are there. They're organizing their work from the night before. They're getting ready for the day today. Everybody's read their Wall Street Journal or the New York Post. They kind of have a sense of what's gone on, right? What the issues are in the world, and they're getting ready. And so it got to be like 8:29, and you could hear the plays. It didn't get quiet by any stretch, but you could hear that the tone kind of subsided because everyone was just waiting to see if there was going to be the surprise announcement. Not that we would have seen it, because there was no television. There was no Bloomberg machines on the floor. There was no internet, no LinkedIn, no Twitter, no Facebook, nothing. So the only way we're going to see it is the phone rang. And so at 8:30 and maybe 30 seconds, every single phone on the floor lit up almost in concert at the same time. And they were these industrial metal phones that had six push buttons on each side. So there were 12 potential lines and they were stacked two on two, but they were the industrial metal steel phones, right? They weren't these fancy phones you see today that sing and dance and play all kinds of songs. They were real institutional phones. And so at 8:30 and 30 seconds, every single phone on the floor lit up. Every phone. It was like Christmas and you could hear it because the phones actually rang like they rang versus today they sing songs, right? And so it was unbelievable. And so you picked up the phone and the guy on the other end, could have been Brian, could have been you as a trader at any one of these big firms, picked up and said, did you see what happened? No, I didn't see what happened. What the fuck happened? Because you could tell that it was going to be exciting. And what actually happened was the Fed came out with a surprise announcement. They opened the door. They step out to the podium. Paul Volcker announces that in order to break the back of inflation, in order to break the back of unemployment, and to bring rates down, the Fed was cutting rates by, listen to this, 10%. 10% when they're at 20%. A 10% move in interest rates is 2 full percentage points. Think about that just for 1 minute, because today they're talking about, well, they, not today necessarily, but a year ago when they were talking about raising rates by 0.25%, everyone was having a nervous friggin' breakdown. So this day they announced that they're cutting rates by 10%. And this was why, bing, 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 he lists off all the reasons, you know, breaking the back of inflation, all that shit. And so what did he do? By cutting rates 10%, he drew a line in the sand. He made it very clear to the markets and to the world that rates in the United States were coming down, which meant what? What were people with money going to then do? They were going to take their money out of the bank and buy stocks the same way they did in the middle of the crisis in 2007, not COVID, but with the great financial crisis, when the world was falling apart and the Fed and every other central bank cut rates to zero. Money came out of the bank because you couldn't earn any money, and it surged in the markets around the world, right? And so the same thing happened on August 17th, 1982. Remember what I said? On Monday, we traded 30 million shares. On Tuesday, we traded 138 million shares, all by pen and paper. The market might have been up 50 cents or down 25 cents on Monday. On Tuesday, it was up 4.5%, which was 37 points. It wasn't the 37 points. It was the percentage move. So the same percentage move today, you know, would be 3,000, would be like 1,900 points today, right?
Yep.
And the volume, if we did 9 billion today, multiply that by 4, because that's exactly what we did. And so that was the birth of what I would tell you is the greatest bull market that this country and the world has ever seen. And I was 21 years old. I was getting ready to go back to my senior year in college. I was just like, my eyes were like this. I couldn't stand the thought of not being there. I couldn't stand it because I loved every minute of it. But I'd also spent $30,000 at 3 years of college, $10,000 a year is all it cost me. I just put my daughter through Vanderbilt, and, you know, it cost me $300,000, right? One way or the other, I said, listen, I just spent 30 grand. I got one more year to go. I really want to finish. Now understand too, my generation, and I'm now 60, my generation then was the first generation to really have a college education. Because what you did on the floor of the exchange, you didn't learn in college. You didn't learn how to negotiate. You didn't learn how to read a crowd. You didn't learn, you know, it's like playing, and I use this only so because people understand. It's like when you play poker, some people bluff, other people don't. Some people, you know, they expose a little bit. Well, whatever. But it's all the strategy, right? And so the floor of the exchange was the same way. Now, bluffing is different from lying. You couldn't go into the crowd and say you're a seller when you're really a buyer, because that's against the rules. You get thrown out. But if I had 300,000 IBM to buy, I didn't have to go into the crowd, pull my pants down and show everybody what I had. I might go in there and say, listen, I got 20,000 to buy. That's not a lie, because I do have 20,000 to buy. I got 280 behind it, but I do have 20 to buy. So I didn't lie, but it was the amount of information that I would give until I figured out what you were doing, what you were doing. Are you a buyer? Are you a competitor to me? Are you a seller? Because if you're a seller, I want to talk to you, because a buyer can't trade with a buyer. A buyer has to trade with a seller. And so therefore, until everybody found out who was doing what in the crowd, everyone was kind of playing it close to the vest. Listen, it's the same way. Think about this for a minute. You and your wife, you're going out to buy a house, right? You've saved your money. You want to go out and buy a house. You might have $1 million budget to buy a house. You might have it. I can spend $1 million. But the real estate agent brings you to this house and said, listen, you got to look at this house. The house is only offered at $700,000. And it's the perfect house. It's a 4-bedroom colonial on a 1/2 acre of land. It's in a great school district. You love the house. But it's only $700,000. And you go, but I could pay $1 million. Okay, great. What do you do? Do you tell the seller, oh, wait a minute, move out of the way. I'm going to pay you $1 million for the house? No, you bid the guy $500, hoping that he counters you at $600 and you take it. Meanwhile, you could have paid $1 million, but why did you have to? You don't have to. And so think of that. And that real estate transaction takes place over time, days, sometimes weeks. This transaction would take place over seconds or minutes, right? And so it was all that excitement. It was all the information you gathered at the point of sale. And remember, every stock is different. IBM trades very differently than General Electric, trades very differently than Abbott Laboratories, trades very differently than American Telephone because of the stock price, the market capitalization. So they all trade very differently. They have different, the stocks have different personalities. And then the people that were in the crowd have different personalities. But here's the thing. It was the same 5,500 people that worked there every day, the same 5,500 people. So you and I got to be very intimate. Now, not in the biblical way, but we got intimate because we spend that much time together. I know when you walk into the crowd, I know your personality. I know how you trade. I know what you do. You know the same about me. I know if you came in and you had a fight with your wife the night before and you're pissed off, or I know if you come in and you were drunk the night before and you're a little bit of a hangover. You just know that. And so therefore there was this amazing skill that you learned on how to read people, how to read the stock, how to read what was going on. Was there news in the stock that day? Was there news in the sector that day? Some days there's news, some days there's not. Earnings come out, there's news all over the tape. When the earnings aren't happening, maybe there's no news. Or maybe, you know, I'm trying to buy Pepsi, and all of a sudden the Coke plant in Mexico exploded because something happened. And so Coca-Cola stock is going to die. Well, what's going to happen to Pepsi stock? Is Pepsi stock going to follow in suit and trade off, or is Pepsi stock actually going to trade up? Is that a positive or negative for Pepsi? Typically, they would trade in kind with each other. So Coke without Pepsi would go down. But there's no reason for Pepsi to really go down because nothing happened to Pepsi. It happened to Coke, right? And so it was your ability to understand the news. It was your ability to understand the crowd. It was your ability to represent your client that made it all so strategic and creative and exciting. Anyway, so I went back to college in September 1983. I had, and so this guy said to me, listen, you go back to college, I get it. Because this guy had never gone to college. He wasn't able to go to college. This guy, his father passed away when he was 17 years old. He couldn't go to college. He went straight to work on the exchange as a runner, got picked up by a specialist unit, bought a seat in 1974 for $51,000. He used that seat his whole life and career to build a life and a career. And when the place went public in 2005, he sold that seat for $6.8 million. But in fact, he used it for the 40 years that he had a business. So he built a life and a career with it too, right? And the price of the seat would fluctuate depending on the market, right? In 1974, seats were trading at $51,000. A New York City taxi medallion was more expensive. And then in 2004, seats were trading at $1.6 million because the economy was better, right? The economy was better. And so you could, and meanwhile, it fluctuated all in between, all those years in between. It would go up and down. because like a stock, there's only a limited amount of seats, or there were only a limited amount of seats. Today, there's no more seats because when the place went public in 2005, the seats represented the stock in the building. And so if you own the seat, when the place went public, they said, okay, your seat is worth $6.8 million. So you give me the seat, I'm going to give you $6.3 million in stock, and I'm going to give you $500,000 in cash. And you got $6.3 million worth of stock priced at $62 a share, which then traded up to $128. And then the market crashed in 2007, 8, and 9, and the stock traded all the way down to $15 a share. Today, it has gone through a couple of other iterations. Today, it's now owned by ICE, which is a New York Stock Exchange listed company. But I think today it trades at, I think ICE trades at like $160 a share. Let me see. I can tell you right now what it trades at. But one way or the other, if you still owned it, right? Because if you owned it through all those, it trades at $110 a share. If you still owned it during all those iterations, all those buyouts, you know, you went from, you just got new stock in whatever the new company was that bought it, right? So if you didn't sell a share and now you own ICE, you know, it trades at $110 a share. Most people, the people that all got it with own their seats, if they're not dead yet, they're almost dead. And most of them certainly cashed out when they were able to and reallocated the money. Some people didn't. Some people still own stock, which has now been converted into ICE. But, you know, that's part of capitalism. It's part of investing. Anyway, so I went back to college in September of 1982. And this guy had offered me a job upon graduation in May 1983. Now, remember what I said. Kids couldn't get jobs getting out of high school. Guys my age were getting thrown out because the economy sucked. And kids getting out of college couldn't get a job. And so the fact that this guy offered me a job 9 months out in May of 1983, paying me $36,000 a year, I hit the fucking lottery. $36,000 a year in 1983 was a lot of money. Look, it's still a lot of money. I'm not downplaying it. But in 1983, that was a lot. That was a fair amount of money. For a kid
like, for living, yeah, especially where you were, to work in lower Manhattan, $36,000 right. Wouldn't barely get to a cardboard box these days.
No, not today it wouldn't, but then, right, times were very different then. Anyway, so that was how I got started. That was kind of that. I know I took much longer than I expected. That's why I told you 45 minutes is going to go by. We're going to get only on chapter two.
I said that's a minimum.
Okay, go ahead.
So you definitely hit on a lot of things there. I think one of the things that that a lot of traders today or anyone that participates in the market really is might be curious about, I know I am, you know, I've seen movies like Trading Places where you have that chaos of the floor and, you know, you said you were instantly drawn to it. Can you tell us a little bit what's going on the floor there? I know there's buyers and sellers, but how does that all work? I know they're talking in code, they're flashing signals.
Wait, when today or then? Because it's
then.
Two very different.
Okay. I know today the floor it's all electronic.
It's all electronic. So all the human beings are gone and all that excitement no longer exists. Mm-hmm. But then, and now you have to be careful when you talk about flashing signals and all that stuff, because on the American Stock Exchange, they spoke in hand signals because the brokers were down on the floor and the clerks that were representing them were up at a balcony. And so you couldn't actually talk to the person. So you had to speak to them in sign language. On the New York Stock Exchange, sign language, you couldn't use sign language. You had to speak. And so therefore there was none of that. There was no sign language on the New York Stock Exchange. You physically had to go in and ask questions because it was a fair and transparent and open market. So anybody standing in the crowd. So if I walked into Coke and I said to the specialist in Coke, what's the market in Coke? He might say to me, I'm 20 bid off it at a quarter. I'll bid for 5,000. I can offer 10,000. Okay. So there's your market. I'll pay $20 for 5,000 shares. I could offer 10,000 at 20 and a quarter. Because when he said I'm 20 bid off it at a quarter is 25 cents. It's understood that he means 20 and a quarter, not 30 and a quarter. It's understood that he means 20 and a quarter, right? So that's part of the shorthand. So he might say, I'm 20 bid off at a quarter, 5,000 by 10,000, but there's two buyers and there's a seller in the crowd and they're representing their own orders. And so then I would turn around to you as one of the buyers and I'd say to you, Michael, what are you doing at Coke? And you might say to me, I'm a 20 buyer. You didn't lie. You said you're a 20 buyer, which indicates to me that you'd be happy to buy stock at 20 if it became available. But right now it's bidding. No one's selling it at 20. So therefore you're not buying any. And by telling me you're a 20 buyer, you're also telling me that you got a limit. You can't pay 20 and an eighth or 20 and a quarter or 20 and three eighths. I look at Brian. I go, Brian, what are you doing? And you say, I'm a go-along buyer. Okay, which means he's bidding 20, but if the situation changed, could he pay an eighth? Yes. Could he pay a quarter? Yes. Could he pay a half? Sure. Right? But he's not sure yet because he sees that there's 10,000 off it at a quarter. Last sale's an eighth. He just walked into the crowd. He's trying to get a feel of what's going on. Now I walk in. Now he doesn't know what I'm doing yet. So he's again very coy. He just says, I'm a go-along buyer. You say I'm a 20 buyer. You don't indicate to me size. You could have 500,000 to buy. I don't know that yet. I may never know that, or I might, depending on what comes out of my mouth now. I might come into the crowd and then say to look to the seller and say, what are you doing? And that seller might say to me, I could offer 10,000 at a quarter. Okay, so now there's a 20 bid for 5,000 on the specials book that he's representing. There's two 20 buyers in the crowd. I'm going to assume it's at least another 25,000. So now the bid is now 20 for 30,000 shares. You see how that grew? Now, you guys could have much more than that. I'm making a judgment. And at a quarter, the specialist got 10,000 at a quarter. And the person, the seller at a quarter just said they can offer 10,000. So now there's 20,000 off it at a quarter. Do you see how the picture changed from when I first walked in? But that's because I had this conversation. And okay. This is where it all came together, right?
Can I interrupt and just ask some questions? Because So when you're trading on the floor, are you representing a larger interest? And are they giving you discretion to make that trade? Like you can decide at will to do it? Or are you like under orders, don't go above this limit or don't do this?
Well, yes and yes, right? Because in Brian's case, his client, his customer told him, I'll pay 20 for Coke, which means I'm giving you a 20 limit. You can't pay higher than that. You can buy it at 19 and 7/8 and 19 and 3/4. You can even buy it at 19 and a half if it trades there, but you can't pay above 20. You, on the other hand, told me you're a go-along buyer. So that means your customer has said to you, Brian, I got to buy 50,000 shares of Coke. I don't have a limit. So use your head. Don't go in there and just fucking start taking offerings. Go assess the situation. See what's around. Is there a big offering? Work the order. Don't just pull your pants down and fucking go at it. Use your head. Like the house situation. It's offered at 700. Bid the guy 500. See what he says. Because the offer is at 600. You're going to buy him. Right?
That makes sense to me. But so do you pocket the difference? Or how do you get... How do you profit? Or do you just... You're known as a good trader.
No. I made my money on commission. Made no difference how I executed that order. If I saved the guy $0.50, if he was willing to buy him at 20, I bought him all at 19 and a half. I saved him 50 cents on 100,000 shares. That's a fair amount of money. I shared not in that at all. I just billed him 2 cents a share for the 100,000 shares. Right. So I made my money on commission. He may like the job that I did. I just saved him a half a point on 50 cents on 100,000 shares. He may think that's great. So what's he going to do? He's probably going to do more business with me. Right. Because I'm a good broker. He likes me. I get a sense of what's going on in the market. I represent him well. So therefore, I'm going to grow my business because people like you who are my customers, if I do a good job for you, potentially you're going to give me more business. Right. But I make nothing. And that's really the misconception. Everybody thought the brokers were making money. They saved an eighth here. They saved a quarter there. So they pocketed. Absolutely not true. Not true. Because that's not how you made your money.
Is that where the specialists and the market makers would come in, though? So they would make their money off the spread?
The specialists and market makers were charged with maintaining a fair and orderly market. And they were trading their own money, their own capital. So they would make money on how well they traded. If they bought stock at 20 and they sold it at a quarter, they just made 25 cents. But they weren't doing that for me. They were doing that for their own account. But there were a set of rules that they had to play by. If I went in there and I bid 20, he couldn't bid 20 with me unless I said to him, you can be a buyer with me. Or if he said to me, you know, Brian, you come in as a seller. And he says to me, Kenny, I'll bid 20 with you. We'll make a bigger bid to Brian, the seller. Because you may have come in and said, listen, I'm working 100,000 for sale. So we may want to bid you 20 for the 100,000. And I've got 70 to buy and he'd buy the other 30. So he would put his capital at risk. He'd put his balls on the line and he'd say, I'll join you in the 20 bid. Let's bid Brian 20 for his 100,000. So if we bid you 20 for your 100,000 and you sold them, that means I bought 70, which I'm happy to do. And he bought 30,000. Now, if right after that, Michael comes in as a buyer and he said, listen, 100,000 just traded at 20. You know, first boss that sold them, Kenny and I bought them. And then Michael says, I'll pay 20 for 10,000. the specials Mike turned around and said, you can have those at an eighth. 10,000 at an eighth. So we just offered him stock up an eighth of a dollar from where he bought them. There's nothing illegal about that. He wasn't there when the stock traded. The specials is now long stock. Now that, but Michael could say, no, thank you. I'm going to just bid 20. And if another seller comes in and Michael buys stock at 20, that's okay. Specials, he offered at an eighth. Michael didn't take him. He's still long the stock at 20, right? But he would make his money based on how well he traded. If he wasn't a good trader, he wasn't going to stick around very long. Because if he bought him at 20 and then five more sales came in and the stock traded down to 19 and he's still choking on the stock he bought at 20 and he's selling it out at 19 or 19 and a quarter, he's losing money. But if another, if three buyers come in after that trade and the stock trades up to 20 and a half and he starts selling it at 20 and a half, he's making a half a buck on his 30,000. Do you understand? But his capital was at risk every single moment of the day, every single moment. And so you have to understand that, because people would say, oh, the specialist knows everything. The specialist knows when it's going to go up. The specialist knows when it's going to go down. Dude, if that were true, they'd all do it for one day and then they'd walk away.
So I'm curious, when you made the deal and you said, okay, this is the deal, this is what we're going to pay. So like, do you then go somewhere and write that down, or you pay, you give the cash? How does that close
there's no
then?
There's no exchange of cash. It is your word is your bond. There's no contracts. There's no lawyers. There's no nothing. I make a bid. I say 20 for your 100,000. You say sold. You say to me, I'm Merrill Lynch. And you have a bet. Remember, people had badges, right? Like, here's my badge. So this was my badge number, right? So I wore that badge on my jacket. You had the same thing with a different number on it. And so I would say, okay, I just bought 100,000 shares from, you know, broker 234. Giving up Merrill Lynch at 2:05 in the afternoon. That's all I did. You, on the other hand, would say, I just sold 100,000 shares to broker 1961 at 2:04. You wouldn't write my name down, because 1961 was me. I was the only one on the floor that had that number. So if you had a question with 1961, you knew that was me. You weren't writing my name down and my address and my phone number. Fuck that. You wrote my badge number down and the time of the trade and exactly what you did. That's all you did. That's how the trade happened. There was no exchange of cash. The cash happened in the clearing and settlement, which was a whole different part of the business that I had nothing to do with, right? I would submit the trade. I would tell my customer, okay, you just bought 100,000 shares at 20. He would write his ticket, submit it to his brokerage firm. I'd write the ticket, send it to the brokerage firm. That would pair off. Who'd you buy it from? I said, I bought it from Merrill Lynch. You, on the other hand, submitted your ticket to your client. He submitted his ticket to the clearinghouse. You submitted your ticket to the clearinghouse, and the two trades would match. That's how it happened, right? What's important about that question, and it's very important, is trading on the floor happened because your word was your bond. If you bid 20 for 100,000 and somebody said sold, you just bought 100,000 shares at 20. Do you understand? There was no question about it. So if you went in there and you say you didn't have 100,000 to buy, and you were trying to, you know, you were acting like an idiot. You walked in, 20 for 100,000. Meanwhile, you had 20,000 to buy. Oh, I'll pay 20 for 100. If I said sold to you, dude, whether you have them to buy or not, you just bought them, which means 80,000 of those shares is going in your error account. Now you personally along 80,000, you've got to sell them because you're not down there to trade them, right? So the rules kept everybody very much in line. Because listen, you had a couple of those mistakes and they cost you a lot of money. You don't have those mistakes anymore. Do you understand? Yeah. And so to answer your question, what people need to understand is what was so, so fantastic about the way the floor used to work was that there were 5,500 people whose word was their bond, and there was never a question, never a question. Because actually, I should say it this way. Out of the 5,500 people, there were 1,366 members. So there were 1,366 guys that had this badge on. Those were the ones whose word were their bonds, because the other people were assistants and they were not members. So therefore, not that they could lie, and everybody, you treated everybody as if their word was their bond. But if you really want to specify it, the person you traded with was always the broker, the guy that had the badge on, and he's the only person that you had to worry about his word was his bond. Right. But it all happened. And listen, billions of dollars traded every single day on that premise. My word is my bond. That's it. No contracts, no lawyers, no bullshit. Right.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's just amazing from, you know,
where amazing.
We are, where we are now to where we were.
Yeah. Well, today, now it's completely electronic, right? I mean, there's no, they destroyed, they all the people are gone. If you look at the floor of the exchange today, you don't really see anybody. You see people on the opening and on the close. That's it. In the middle of the day, everybody's gone back into the booth. And by the way, the 5,500 people that used to work on the floor in five trading rooms that made up the whole exchange are now less than 200 people, and they're all back in one room doing the same job that 5,500 people in five rooms used to do.
So I was just thinking
about how technology has destroyed all those jobs, right?
Yeah, it was a lot. I would say technology has it's very much changed the way the markets operate. Absolutely, you know, like you were even saying, down to pennies and sub pennies and everything else. Yeah. I was curious. So how an order? So once you made an order, you know, you bought 100 at 20 or 100 at 20 and an eighth. How did that order end up on the Bloomberg terminal, or how was that reported? You know, how did the information get out?
Because they part of the 5,500 people that were on the floor were actually employees of the New York Stock Exchange whose sole job was to stand. There's what you call a reporter, and there was one reporter for every single section. And every time a stock traded, the seller, in this case, if you were the buyer, Brian, and I was the seller, it was always the seller's responsibility to report the trade. So you might go in and sell, pay $2,400, and I said sold. I would turn around to that employee of the New York Stock Exchange, who's called the reporter, and say to him, 100,000 Coke just traded at 20. And so he, and I'd have to find old footage to see it, but he used to have this deck of IBM cards in his hand. You know, like when you take an SAT test, the little circles used to fill them in. So this kid, man, woman, and I say a kid because they were really amazing, especially in stocks that were really active. These kids, they it's like anything, you know, you have to know what to listen for. And the reporter would be right in the middle of the crowd, and he'd be taking every time a stock traded, he'd fill out one of these little cards and take the card and stick it in the machine, which was the reader. The reader then would print it on the tape. That's how you knew it traded. And then it traded. He would put in there on part of that ticket, he would actually put in there 1961 because I was the seller. So the seller's number was always associated with every trade. So if there was a question, the exchange, the SEC, anybody, the FINRA, whoever, if they had a question on this 100,000 shares that traded 20, they would always find the seller. And then they'd say to me, where'd this order come from? So say there was a reason. They were doing an investigation. There was, you know, something going on in the stock. There was, right? Like maybe there was news out, you know, that the stock was very active on Monday. And then on Tuesday, there's an announcement that it's getting taken over. So on days like that, the SEC would immediately start to investigate trading in the stock in the days before the announcement came out. And they'd try to trace. And so they'd say to me, okay, you sold 100,000 shares at 20. Where'd that order come from? I said, it came from Merrill Lynch, or it came from Bear Stearns. Those were the brokers. Now, I don't know ultimately who it came from, because ultimately it came from an institution. So it could have been Wellington or Fidelity or American Capital, or it could have been T. Rowe Price, or it could have been Waddell & Reed, whatever institution it came from. But you could trace that order back to its origination, right? And so the seller would be responsible for reporting every trade that happened. But to report it, to get it on the tape, it was that person, man or woman, that would sit there all day long and just fill in these little IBM cards and stick it in the machine all day long. That's what they did.
So I'm just kind of, you know, just for because everything's happened just so quick right now. You know, I send in an order for Apple at 110, instantly it's executed and it's out there for everyone to see. And now if I was to call my broker or even whoever I was trading with, how long would it really take for me to go and say, okay, I want 100 of GE? How long would that take to print on the tape? Just ballpark. I'm just kind of curious to compare it to today.
So first of all, Apple didn't trade on the New York Stock Exchange. I trade on NASDAQ. So that's a bad example. Fair but enough. Say you GE or American Telephone, right? So if you... Now, are you talking you as Michael, a retail investor?
Retail investor.
Okay. So your order is going to go to your broker, whoever it is, Merrill Lynch, TD Ameritrade, whoever it was. And that broker would then send that order into the market. Now, either it's with a limit, because you said I'll buy 100 shares of General Electric at $20. Well, if General Electric's trading at $25, your order is just going to sit on the book way below. It's not going to get executed, right? Or if you say I'll buy 100 shares of GE at the market, which means you'll buy it at the prevailing market price. If it's trading 20 bit off and at a quarter, you're going to most likely either pay an eighth or a quarter, right? That order is going to get represented into the crowd and it's going to trade. Now, the truth is your retail order, that 100 shares of American Telephone or GE or whatever, never came to the floor like that. The New York Stock Exchange was an institutional marketplace. So typically what would happen is that, you know, Merrill Lynch, if that was your broker, all day long, the Merrill retail brokers would be submitting orders to buy stock and sell stock. And so they would congregate, you know, they had a bunch of clients, everyone wanted to buy GE. So they would then combine all those orders. So instead of sending an order to buy 100 shares of GE to the exchange, they might send an order to buy 10,000 shares of GE because they've got, you know, either 5,000 customers that want to buy between 100 and 200 shares, or they've got 10,000 customers want to buy 100 shares each. And so the order would get executed and then everybody would get that same price, right? That's how that would happen. And so because today it doesn't even happen that way anymore, because today there are so many alternative venues that the orders get rerouted. It doesn't even necessarily end up at the New York Stock Exchange.
Absolutely. Well, that's really interesting. I'd love to just hear about, yeah, where it's been, where it's come to. You know, I've studied some of the books out there where when the market became digitalized and computerized, and just, you know, there's certainly pluses and minuses for sure.
And so that happened post the turn of the century, right?
I'm just curious, in that whole period, so were they just at orders in the morning, or were the retail investors able to track intraday and know, like, could they turn on television and watch it or something?
Of course they could. That was what you watched CNBC for. You watched, any one of those cable business channels. You could see it all day. Now, they didn't let television on the floor until 1998. That's when Dick Grasso, who was CEO of the New York Stock Exchange, allowed Maria Bartiromo and CNBC to broadcast live from the floor of the exchange. It was a brilliant move because he brought the New York Stock Exchange and capitalism into households around the world. It was an amazing, amazing decision he made. Because prior to that, you couldn't see it, right? Prior to that, you couldn't see it. No internet. I mean, internet by 1998 was here, yes, but there was no way to see what was going on the floor until he allowed the cameras and the media to come onto the floor. And then once CNBC did it, then everybody jumped on, right? CNN did it, Reuters did it, and, you know, El Economista did it, and, you know, media stations from around the world did it. But yes, you could watch the action all day. You couldn't necessarily trace your exact order, but you could watch the action. The same way you can, well, you can't watch it today because with COVID and everything, that no one's on the floor anymore in terms of media, so you can't see it anymore.
I think that's just really interesting because, again, like, you know, if there's a flash crash happening, or if there's, like, you know, one security that you're really interested in, could you, like, what if CNBC is not showing that one while I'm, like,
well,
you know?
So you can go on Yahoo and watch that stock. You can go on your Bloomberg machine and watch that stock.
Yeah,
you could type it in and you could see how it's trading, right? All you'll see is you'll see it as it trades, right? But you can do that today. You could certainly do that today. If you're watching, tomorrow morning they announce, you know, Moderna and it's COVID vaccine and all that shit, and the stock trades up another $50. And you want to see how it's trading, you can actually go on. You have to subscribe to it. It's called Times and Sales. And you can actually see every single tick in that stock.
Right? Yeah, I guess I think it's interesting how that would have happened in, like, 1983. You know?
Well, it didn't happen in 1983. In 1983, the only thing you saw was you saw the ticker tape. So every time a stock traded, that's what they would call, you know, good traders were able to read the tape, right? So they could tell the way the stocks were trading, right? What stocks were up? What sectors were going up, and what sectors were going down? And it gave you a sense of, you know, the shift of money. Was money moving into the industrial names and out of the banking names? All the banking stocks were low, yet all the industrial names were higher. You know, was it value? Was it growth? Was it healthcare? Was it technology? Right? You'd have to be able to read the tape. Today, that's less so because the information is so transparent and you could see it on almost everywhere that the reading the tape anymore is like a lost art, you know?
Yeah.
So we came through a lot there. I know we've bounced around a little bit. I did want to talk a little bit about crisis, because we mentioned a few of the crises that you've lived through, whether it was the dot-com bubble, the 2007, 2008 financial crisis, and even COVID, the COVID pandemic, of March crash that we had here this past year. But one that always lives in infamy and you know, is talked about a lot, but you know, I was 2 years old when it happened, the 1987 market crash. You were working on the floor at that time.
I was, hold on. We'll call you. I was 26 years old. And I had just gotten married. We just had a baby. We just bought a house. The market crashed. Now what you have to understand is what led up to that and how it led up to that. But remember what I said, in 1982, the Dow was trading at 792. By 1987, the Dow was trading at 2,700, 2,800. That was a massive move in the Dow over 5 years, right? Think about it. Just it was 700, 1,400, 2,100. That was like a 350% move over 5 years. And so if you were an asset manager, you know, like a Wellington or a Fidelity or an asset manager, you had these huge gains in your portfolios. I mean, the market was on fire and investors were making money hand over fist, you know, people that were invested in the market. And so what had happened as we moved into 1987 was, it really foretells what was to come, because there was this industry that suddenly popped up in colleges with the advancement of technology, computers. Now, it's funny, I just missed it. By the time I graduated college in 1979, computers were just learning how to spell the word computer. And by the time I got out of college in 1983, computer programming and quantitative analysis were just industries that were, you know, I was a senior and they were, you know, just starting to talk about them. So I missed it in high school and I missed it in college, but whatever. But in the mid 80s, there was this industry that popped up called, you know, quantitative analysis and computer programming and all that shit. And so you had these couple of guys and they were not business students. They were physicists and engineers, and they were quantitative. They were called them quants, right? Quantitative analysts, which was part of this new industry that was being born. And then these guys used technology to help them implement these newfound strategies. And so what they did was they designed this thing called portfolio insurance. And insurance is just that. It's an insurance product. An insurance product protects you against a loss. Health insurance, disability insurance, life insurance, right? Your car insurance, you're protected against a loss. So portfolio insurance was a product designed by these non-business people to protect you as the asset manager, your portfolio. So, you know, you had these massive gains in stocks. And so you didn't want to see those massive gains get fucking wiped away. So these guys designed this product, which guaranteed that you wouldn't lose your money. This was insurance. You just had to buy it. You'd never lose a fucking penny. Okay. So they did this in, 1987, they were building this and they would design it. And the greatest thing about these tech guys is they always backtest in a perfect environment. They never backtest when the shit hits the fan. They always backtest it when everything is just right. They go, oh, look, it works perfectly. Really? Well, 1987 proves to you it doesn't work so perfectly. Because what ended up happening was, the market continued to surge through the summer of 1987. And then what happened is the global economy started to falter. We had had 5 years of this massive global growth. But, you know, business cycles and markets go through these boom bust cycles, right? Recession, expansion, recession, expansion, recession, expansion. And part of that is healthy, because it kind of shakes when the market gets too high, kind of shakes and rattles the trees, brings it back down to normal, and so on and so forth. And so 1987, as the global economy started to stutter and falter, economic data from Asia, economic data from Europe, economic data in the US started to decline. So the market started to come under some pressure, and the Dow would trade from, you know, 2,800 down to 2,750 and then back up to 2,775 and back down to 2,725 and then back up to 2,800. And, right, it was churning, but it was every time it made a new low, it made a new low. Nothing dramatic, just kind of inching its way. And so therefore, this portfolio insurance was never triggered. An event to trigger it never really happened because it was the market was in a methodical way. It was just churning and clearing itself out. So there was no reason to panic. Now, remember what I said in 1987, there was no internet. There's no Twitter, Facebook, fucking stock twits and all that other shit that's out there. Right. And so therefore the news moved around the world the way the news moved around the world. And that was by newspaper and maybe a telephone call. You know, people would talk to each other. But mostly people in 1987 got their news by picking up the newspaper. Well, here's the problem with picking up the newspaper. The newspaper tells you what happened yesterday. It doesn't tell you what's happening right now or 10 minutes ago. It's telling you yesterday. And newspapers on Monday morning told you what happened on Friday. They didn't tell you what happened on Sunday, right? Business, like the Wall Street Journal. They told you what happened on Friday in the markets, right? But it was Monday morning. So as we moved into the fall, the macro data around the world started getting worse and worse, and the markets are coming under pressure. And then we moved into October. And it was the week of October 14th, 15th, and 16th, which was a Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. And the U.S. market, as well as the global markets, started coming under increasing pressure. And the volume picked up and the sell pressure got worse, right? And so on the Wednesday, the market, you know, traded down. I think it might have I'm going to make this up because I'm trying to remember. The market might have closed down 80 points, which was a big move in 1987. Then on Thursday, it might have and it closed on the low. And then on Thursday, it traded down another 100 points and closed on the low. And then on Friday, it closed down 190 points. That was a massive move. 1987, that was a fucking massive move. And the volume spiked. And it was happening in global markets around the world, Europe and Asia and all that shit. Now, remember, the markets, although they were connected, they weren't as connected as they are today, right? And so over the weekend, these quant guys, these physicists and these fucking engineers take all the macro data and all the pricing data and all the stock trading data, and they feed it into the big IBM super-ass computer. And the IBM computer spits out a fucking action. And now the action was, in order to protect your portfolio, you need to sell 2%. You need to sell 2% of your holdings, right? Whatever 2% is. You manage 100 million, he manages a billion. Your 2% is very different from his 2%, but it's 2%, right? So think about this for a minute. All this shit happens over the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, when the markets are closed. Sunday night in New York at 9 o'clock is what in China and Asia? Monday at 9 o'clock. So when I'm tucking myself into my bed on Sunday night at 9 o'clock, getting ready for Monday morning, trading in Asia has already begun. And so since Asia is the first market in the world. Asia, Australia, Singapore, those markets are the first ones in the world to trade every Sunday night in New York. They were the first ones to get the message, right? So the portfolio insurance says that any one of those institutional asset managers who bought that product, you need to sell 2% of your portfolio and raise the cash and then put the cash on the side. Don't invest it. Let it sit there until we give you the buy signal and put the money back to work. So the Asian market starts to come unglued. But 2% wasn't a drastic amount, but it was enough to put the market under pressure. But what happened was everybody that bought the product got a sell order. Nobody got a buy order. And so here you guys spent good money on this computer product and it told you to sell. So whether or not you believe it, you paid money for this product and now the product told you to sell. So you go, I have to sell because that's what it fucking told you to do. And it was like on that day, and you'll see why I say this. It was like the human beings fucking took the brains out of their head and put it over here and just did what the computer told them to do because the computer was because the computer was, you know, it was the age of technology. It was going to change the world. It was smarter than you, right? And so now the Asian markets start to come unglued. And then these portfolio insurance guys go, holy shit, like the Asian markets came under more pressure than we expected. So they took all the Asian data that traded on Monday and they refed it to the computer. And so when the sun sets in Asia, it rises in Europe. And so who's next to get the message? The European asset managers. Except the problem is this, because of what happened in Asia, the Europeans' message is you need to sell 3% of your portfolio. Why? Because the data got worse on Monday in Asia, right? So now the European asset managers were told they have to sell 3% of their portfolio. Do you see where this is going?
Yes.
So now the European markets begin to, now the European markets, they look and they say, okay, what happened in Asia? Then they see Asian markets close lower, significantly lower. So everybody starts to get a little bit nervous. And all of a sudden this portfolio insurance said, sell, 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 sell. So if you bought the product, again, you took your brain out of your head and you just sold, 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 sold. Now, you sold what you were able to and not necessarily what you should have, because in order to raise 2%, and you need to raise 2% fairly, you know, quickly, you need to sell stuff that's highly capitalized, stuff that's liquid, right? And so now I wake up at 5 o'clock in the morning in New York. Trading in Asia is already over for Monday. Trading in Europe is now midday. I get up, I take a shower, I shave, I get dressed, I get in my car, I get onto the train station, I buy my cup of coffee, and I pick up the Wall Street Journal. Great. I get in the train, I read what happened. I know what happened on Friday. I know the markets came under pressure. I'm just rereading it because that's what the newspaper is telling me. Meanwhile, fucking Monday has already passed, and the markets are under pressure, and the Wall Street Journal is saying to me, not telling me anything about Monday. It's telling me about what happened last Friday. And it's also telling me what happened last Friday in Europe. Meanwhile, the European markets are coming unglued. And so these same portfolio insurance guys see now what's happening in Europe. And the day is still going on, because don't forget, when our market opens at 9, it's still the trading day in Europe. And so these portfolio insurance guys now take the latest data that they can get out of Europe in terms of prices. And guess what they do with it? Put it back in the fucking computer. And guess what the computer says now to the Americans?
Sell more.
You have to sell 5% of your portfolio. Do you see what's just exponentially it's increased? And so our market fell 22.5% in 6.5 hours. And stocks like Johnson & Johnson, which had closed at $96 on Friday night, closed at $45 on Monday night. That stock lost 50% of its value in 6.5 hours. Why? It's Johnson & Johnson. It's one of the greatest American companies in the world. They make fucking baby powder. But it's a big company, right? It's highly capitalized. So people sold what they, why the fuck? Who wants to buy Bank of Hawaii? Go try selling Bank of Hawaii. Not a bid in town. But, you know, Johnson & Johnson is a big name company. So there were people that were willing. Listen, if you were willing to pay $96 on Friday night, you were certainly happy to pay 90. And then after you bought them at 90, now it's trading at 80 because the sell is just boom, boom, boom. Because I would come back and I'd say to you, Brian, this thing is down 15 points. It's Johnson & Johnson. Are you sure? And you'd say to me, can you sell the fucking stock? Okay. I'd go back out to Johnson like everybody else. Boom, boom, boom. Because that's what the computer told you to do. And therefore, that's what you told me to do. Meanwhile, I might be saying, Brian, Johnson & Johnson is down $30. It was trading at $96 on Friday and you were happy to buy it. Now it's trading at 66 and you can't sell it fast enough. Like, I think there's a disconnect here. But because you didn't give a shit what I thought, this computer program that you spent a lot of money on buying to protect your portfolio told you to sell the fucking stock. So you, like everybody else on the street that had that program, sell, 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 sell. Don't come back until you've sold it all. Okay. And so the market collapsed 22.5% in 6.5 hours. And there was paper all over the floor. And we were there until 9 o'clock at night verifying trades. And because Johnson & Johnson had a 50-point swing. at 9:30 or 10 o'clock in the morning, I'm selling it to you at $90. And at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm selling it to fucking Michael at $45. Do you understand?
It makes a lot of sense. And I think that's where the disconnects a lot of people do have, is it all comes down to supply and demand, right? It doesn't necessarily matter.
No, it's all about supply. It's all about supply and demand, and it's all about emotion, right?
And
what happened on that day in 1987, because, you know, technology was new, this product was new, it was untested in a difficult environment. Because after it was over, everybody said, "What the fuck just happened?" And then, as a result of that event, then out of that was born a whole new set of rules, circuit breakers, points in the market where they would halt trading in the market so that everybody could take a breath and go, what's going on? Stop for a minute. Let's think about what's happening. And so out of that event then was born a whole new set of regulations, because those regulations hadn't existed prior, because this technology hadn't existed prior. Right? And so therefore, nobody really knew. And when they back-tested the system, they back-tested when the market's doing nothing but going up and patting themselves on the back and saying, look what a great job we did. Meanwhile, they fucked the place. By the way, I apologize. Who's going to listen to this?
You're fine. You're fine.
No, because I'm probably going to insult half your people that listen to this.
No, we have a lot of people that are geared mostly towards newer people in the market.
Yeah, but are you in the Bible Belt?
Yeah, we're in North Carolina. But this is we're a national. We actually have international listeners. You don't worry.
Be honest. Be yourself.
The point is, part of that is what makes it real, right? Part of that's what makes it real, because you can feel the emotion in my voice because it makes it real.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you so much for being with us, Kenny. This is Trading for Keeps. I'm Brian.
And this is Michael. Thanks for listening.